So thank you, Alain, for inviting me. I have to say I didn't invite myself. In fact, I tried very hard to get out of this. Originally, we had invited Phil Avner, in fact, because he actually did work with François Jacob, in particular at the time when François Jacob decided to move into working with Terra Termas. And unfortunately, Phil couldn't make it. But as I started my career in Exon Activation with Phil Avner, and actually I started in the building where François Jacob was, the Bâtiment Jacques Monod at the Pasteur, where I spent many years, I feel that I kind of fit in a little bit. So thank you. I don't need to spend much time, I think, convincing you that the findings of François Jacob and Monod and Leboeuf laid the foundations of what we are understanding about gene regulation. The one thing I want to point out from this operon scheme is what was pointed out at the time, they didn't actually know necessarily whether the regulatory molecule was a protein or an RNA. And what I'm going to be telling you about today in the process of exon activation is that actually, in some cases, it can be an RNA that acts in a regulatory way to repress genes in cis. And so I just want to highlight here this quotation, which is that indeed the discovery of these regulators and operator genes and of repressive regulation of the activity of structural genes revealed that the genome contains not just a series of blueprints, but a coordinated program of protein synthesis and the means of controlling its execution. And of course, what Jacob and Monod were interested in was to find out to what extent we could extrapolate this from bacteria to elephants or maybe some other mammals. And it seemed as if this was indeed going to be the rule, and it is the rule, but it turned out to be much more complicated, as you've been hearing, and as you all know, than just being a case of local binding sites for regulatory proteins and a promoter and some exons. And the main problem in eukaryotes is that this concept is much more complex because of the larger size of the genomes involved and the complexity of the genomes and the increased numbers of proteins working as complexes. And as I think Denis Deboul very beautifully illustrated, What we were centering on for many, many years was the gene, but in fact now we're realizing that in many cases it's the enhancers that might be taking up most of the space. And so when in 2003 the human genome sequence was published, there was a lot of hope and hype that this would actually give us the key to the way indeed, mammals might function. And so the question was, how do you actually work this out from the 20,000 genes in this 3 billion base pairs of DNA? How do you coordinate gene expression during development to produce such fascinating individuals as humans and elephants? And how do you establish cell identity and then maintain it? And how do you respond to environmental stimuli? And also, and this is what I'm going to be telling you about, how can you, in some cases, also regulate very finely gene dosage in some processes, such as X chromosome inactivation. And the problem is, of course, that it wasn't just the DNA, it's the DNA packaged in chromatin, and the chromatin is not just a string of nucleosomes, it's actually very complicated organization within the nucleus with heterochromatin and euchromatin, more open and more condensed chromatin. So the question was, how does one make sense out of all of this and maybe use a genomic sequence to try and help us make sense? And so this is a cartoon that I'm sure many of you have seen. So the genome was sequenced, but we still haven't worked out how to fold it. And so this is where, in recent years, there have been some important insights that have come from technologies. So for a long time, we based studies on detection by fluorescence microscopy, for example, of where sequences were using hybridization. And so these are chromosome positioning, chromosome territories labeled here. And we knew that chromosomes were positioned in different parts of the nucleus. They weren't just all mixed up in a jumble. And we also knew that at the level of genes, of course, there are these regulatory elements or enhancers and other types of elements that presumably have to link up to the promoters that they regulate. But sometimes these can be a long, long way away. And it was just recently, a few years ago, as Denis already introduced, that it was discovered that actually there's another layer of folding in the nucleus that wasn't, of chromosomes, that wasn't very well understood, which turned out using these chromosome conformation capture techniques. And it turns out that indeed they're folded into these topologically associating domains of more frequent interactions of sequences, separated by these borders or boundaries. And these borders or boundaries seem to be quite highly conserved between man and mouse, as the paper of Bing Ren showed. And so in my lab, we stumbled across these regions because we were focused on a very particular region of the X chromosome, the X inactivation center. And Alferj Nora, a student in my lab, a very, very talented student who worked with Job Dacko briefly and came back and then actually explored these topologically associated domains, also showed by structural illumination that indeed sequences that lie within one of these domains tend to overlap very frequently. And this is very similar to what Denis showed you, whereas sequences that lie in two separate domains tend to be spatially segregated. And so what are these about? Well, we've heard that indeed they could be ways of encompassing enhancer promoter interactions. They might even be caused by such interactions or other types of structural elements. What we showed in our study was that actually during development, they allow for coordinated developmental gene expression during early differentiation, at least at the region that we looked at. Genes within a TAD will tend to show the same dynamics of either up or down regulation compared to genes in separate TADs, which tend to show different regulation. So they seem to partition regulatory landscapes. And one of the questions that's still fairly open, I think, is what actually creates these TADs, and are they actually a cause of dynamic gene activity, or might they also be a consequence? Very little is known, but because they're quite stable across differentiation, the idea was that they're actually rather immutable systems that don't change too much in the course of development. And so what I'm going to tell you about today is a story where we've been trying to explore the way that gene regulation happens in the context of one chromosome, the X, using the process of X inactivation as a way of looking at both euchromatin and heterochromatin. And very briefly, I hope that you've all heard of this process. It's the way that mammals achieve dosage compensation between the sexes. So one of the two X chromosomes is shut down in females. This occurs during early development, and it was the seminal work of Mary Lyon in 1961 that actually put forward this hypothesis that one of the two X's becomes transcriptionally silenced very early on. This process is usually random, and once the X chromosome is shut down, it's then maintained in this way. So there's a cellular memory that kicks in and keeps one X off and the other X on. And so you end up with mosaics of cells expressing either one allele of X-linked genes or the other allele. And this is translated in cats and mice by these variegated coat color patterns. But actually, if we go to humans, it's been shown that indeed X inactivation leads to a great deal of variability in X-linked gene expression. On top of the mosaicism, there are some genes that can even escape this process into variable degrees. And I think this quote of Hunt Willard, who actually found this phenomenon of escape, is quite nice because genetically speaking, this is a man speaking. So genetically speaking, if you've met one man, you've met them all. We are, I hate to say, predictable. You can't say that about women. Men and women are further apart than we ever knew. It's not Mars or Venus, it's all the other planets. So how does this process actually work? And this is what my lab has been working on for many years. And it was discovered by Hunt Willard and Sahela Rastan that a non-coding RNA is produced from this region that I mentioned, the X inactivation center, that actually expressed this non-coding RNA and regulates it in a monoallelic fashion. And only one of the two X chromosomes will express this exist RNA, which when it becomes upregulated during development, will coat one of the two X chromosomes in cis and trigger its silencing. And we know that exist is essential because if you knock it out, you can no longer trigger this chromosome-wide gene silencing process. But once gene silencing has been established, it then becomes locked in through a series of marks at the level of chromatin, so epigenetic marks such as polychrome-associated changes and DNA methylation, and also asynchronous replication timing and a shift in nuclear organization. And furthermore, when we use fluorescence microscopy, we can see that indeed the inactive X is gathered up at the nuclear periphery, usually, and actually seems to be more condensed than its active counterpart. But we don't actually know that much about how it's organized, and I'll come to that in a minute. So as I said, the existing RNA is the key trigger for this process, and for many years, we and others were working on trying to find out how this RNA is regulated and how it works. Where does it bind, and what does it do there? So we know that as soon as this accumulates on the X chromosome, the transcriptional apparatus seems to become lost. And then later on, we see these chromatin changes that I mentioned. And this year, in fact, 5 papers have now come out that have discovered the partners of EXIST, the proteins that actually bind to EXIST. And this has become it's extremely exciting and very revealing. And in one of these papers that we were collaborators on with Howard Chang's lab, it was found that 81 different proteins associate with this RNA. Some of them seem to have a very direct role in gene silencing, and others seem to induce other changes. And in particular, some of these proteins are probably involved in helping to create a silent nuclear compartment. Which is something that we had actually already stumbled across many years ago. This was the work of another talented PhD student, Julie Chomet, in my lab, and a postdoc, Jen Chow, who, looking at EXIST RNA accumulation and POL2, and as well as nascent RNA transcription, found that indeed, as soon as EXIST coats the chromosome, you actually see this loss of RNA POL2. And furthermore, what Julie was able to show was that genes, when they're still expressed, and this is using RNA FISH to detect nascent transcripts, when genes are expressed, they lie outside of this EXIST-coated silent compartment, but then as they become silenced, they become relocated within it. And the only genes that remain external to this EXIST-coated compartment are genes that escape. And so, indeed, there are some genes that seem to be able to bypass this process or override it. And so what I showed you earlier can be added to. There are actually 2 ways that genes seem to be able to escape. One of them is in a constitutive fashion. They always escape whatever tissues one looks at. Again, here we don't actually know how this works, but we know that they seem to always be located outside this compartment, and so maybe there is some kind of a looping process, or maybe there's specialized transcription factors or some specialized chromatin state. And then other genes that my lab and others stumbled across seem to escape in a more lineage-specific fashion. They do it, in other words, they get silenced, and then they can re-escape. They become fully shut off, and then they come back on, but only in very specific tissues and lineages. And this is something that we're very interested in, because indeed, these genes clearly have to be or are dosage compensated early on, but then later on become re-expressed, and there could be good reasons for this. So to get back to how EXIST is working, a recent study by Mitch Gutman's lab showed, actually using this technique of RAP to map where EXIST locates, that EXIST initially binds a few sites and then seems to spread across the whole chromosome. But genes that escape don't seem to be coated by EXIST RNA. So this fits with what I just showed you in terms in the three-dimensional context. What they also found was that using this chromosome conformation capture maps published by Bing Ren, that the first regions that EXIST associates with are the regions that the EXIST locus is actually interacting with in 3D space along the chromosome. So that was very interesting, because it means that indeed this 3D dynamics could be important for placing EXIST where it initially goes. The RNA needs to be placed, perhaps. And so this was something that that came out a couple of years ago. But one thing that remained a completely open question that hadn't been explored was, what is the molecular architecture then of the inactive X? Once EXIST is coated and you start to silence it, what happens to the folding of the chromosome? And this is something that we tried to explore using some cell lines that we had developed. And this was the work of Anne-Valérie Jeanrel and Michael Attier in my lab. They developed neural progenitor cells that they derived from ES cells lines that were highly polymorphic for their X chromosomes. That way we could actually distinguish the active from the inactive X at the genomic sequence level. So by differentiating these ES cells and inducing X inactivation randomly and then producing these neural progenitor cells, we could then subclone them. And so each clone would have only one or the other of the X chromosomes inactivated. And using these clonal cell lines, we could then distinguish the chromosome folding of the two X's, the active and the inactive. And so this is the HiC technique that Denis Duboul already alluded to, where indeed we're actually exploring all of the interactions that any one sequence or any sequences together make. And so what we end up with are these heat maps that you saw slightly earlier. And so this is actually the whole X chromosome. This is the active X and this is the inactive X. And so I hope you can see that on the active X, you have this organization into TADs all along here that you can see quite strikingly, whereas on the inactive X, it seems that there's a much lesser such organization. However, what we do see is a very global organization into two very large megadomains, as we call them. And it turns out that these two megadomains that are several tens of megabases long are separated by a rather unique region, which is a DXZ4 macrosatellite region that I don't have time to go into yet today, but which seems to be key in this segregation, because when we delete this region, we no longer see these megadomains forming. So we actually validated this using high-resolution DNA FISH, so using 18 megabase pair oligoprobes that either lie within the same megadomain or in two different megadomains, we could show that indeed the probes that lie within the same megadomain tend to show much more overlap than probes that actually lie in the two different megadomains. And so this was something that confirmed very nicely our HiC data. And what we went on to show is that if you delete exist, if you use a cell line where you can induce exist on the X chromosome, even in undifferentiated cells, exist is enough to create these megadomains and this unusual organization of the X chromosome. However, if you take away the part of exist that is involved in gene silencing, a region known as the repeat A region, you no longer see this formation of megadomains. So this means that exist and its competence to induce gene silencing is responsible for this unusual folding. So if I go back to these maps that I showed you earlier, this is the active X, and then a zoom in of one region to show you these TADs that we've been talking about. So this is the active X, and this is the equivalent region on the inactive X. And you can see, as I mentioned to you, that the TADs seem to be globally lost. This is actually the boundary region between the megadomains. But I hope you can see that there are some regions that do show a little bit of TAD structure. And it turns out that these regions are those regions that seem to escape from X inactivation. So the only regions that seem to show these structures correlate with these regions that escape. And I'm just going back to the slide I showed you earlier here to say that we did RNA sequencing where we could distinguish the expression of the active and inactive X's, and these are four different clones that we looked at. And this, when one X is inactivated, you see red. When the other is inactivated, you see green. And when there's biallelic expression, you see black. And you can see there are several regions here that seem to show biallelic expression, and these are these facultative escapees that I mentioned to you. And this seems to be what overlaps with these TAD-like structures on the inactive X. And just to convince you that this isn't some kind of tissue culture artifact, we actually went in our original paper, we went in and looked in brain sections, and this is all thanks to help actually from the lab of Alain Prochian, using nascent transcript RNA FISH. We could show that some genes, such as MECP2, do show biallelic expression, and very specifically, it seems, in the subventricular zone, which is where presumably neural stem cells are, and we do see expression from the inactive X. And we've gone on and we've also looked in other cell types, for example, trophoblast giant cells with Catherine Corbel, and we see very similar patterns of escapees in these cells as well in vivo. So then, just to go back to what I showed you, it seems that globally, TAD organization is lost on the inactive X. I'm just zooming in here on three different regions. This is a region that contains facultative escapees. In ES cells, this is one allele and the other. They're both expressed. You can see this is the transcription profile here, and you can see that nice TADs are present. Then if you go to the MPCs, this is the active allele, and this is the inactive allele. And as I said to you, on the inactive allele, you see most of the region is actually not transcribed, but there is one region that is transcribed, which includes this MECP2 gene, and all of these regions are actually, it's a very gene-rich region, actually all of these genes are transcribed, and the TAD that we see on the inactive X, which doesn't exactly overlap with the TAD on the active X, this TAD actually corresponds precisely to the region of escape. And if we look at a constitutive SKP that I mentioned to you, and these are genes that escape in all cell types, we do see similar structure on the inactive X. So if there is escape, we do seem to be able to pick up this organization on an otherwise very randomly organized X chromosome. So as I said, these TAD-like structures seem to disappear globally on the inactive X, but only appear in regions that are expressed. This was actually quite unexpected for us. We thought that there would be a global loss and that if expression occurred, there wouldn't necessarily be much structure. The other thing that we did, and I don't have time to show you this, we used a technique called ATAC-seq in collaboration with Howard Chan's lab that allows us to see where chromatin accessibility is present, and you can see the attack seat runs here. It's a little bit like DNA's hypersensitive mapping. And what we found was, in fact, that these SKP regions show some attack seek signal, but it's actually different to the homologous region on the active X. And what we found was that those regions that escape retain accessibility at their promoters and at CTCF sites, but not necessarily at more long-range elements such as enhancers. So here we have TAD-like structure forming with local accessibility at promoters of X-linked genes, but not necessarily the full regulatory landscape being lit up. So then the way we're thinking about this now in terms of the relationship between gene expression and structure on the X, one possibility is that prior to X inactivation, where the X chromosome is happily transcribing and TADs are present in a constitutive sort of way, as X inactivation begins, maybe most TADs are erased, but actually a few TADs remain, and these are the regions that will actually then allow for escape to happen. And this would perhaps then coincide with those regions that are still retained as binding, for example, CTCF locally. On the other hand, another model that one can envisage, and I have to say, at the moment, this is the one that we're favoring more, is that early on during X inactivation, you might lose all structure, except at constitutive SKPs, but at facultative SKPs that get silenced initially, you might lose all structure, but then it could be that it's the act of transcription, escape, perhaps transcription factor driven, perhaps due to upregulated levels of transcription factors, going back to what John Gurdon was talking about at the end of his talk, this might drive expression of some privileged genes on the inactive X, and this might then drive structure. And this is something that we'd like to explore more deeply now, because it has important implications about how these structures form and, of course, what they might mean. So to conclude then, I hope I've convinced you that the active and inactive Xs are actually very different in their organization. The inactive X isn't just a simple blob of heterochromatin as originally defined by Barr. It is a blob of heterochromatin, but it's actually a little bit more complex when you look at the molecular level. It's divided into these two megadomains. We don't actually know what these two megadomains are for, whether they actually play a role, or whether it's a default state and simply created thanks to this boundary region that might have some kind of a tethering role. And this is something that we're testing right now by deleting it. And I also hope I convinced you that regions that can escape from X inactivation seem to do it in a rather special way. We still don't understand the molecular mechanisms, but what we can say is that they seem to loop out of the exist-coated silent compartment, and they seem to be associated with TAB formation. And I just want to leave you with the thought that although X inactivation is probably essential for most genes on the X in females, some genes may actually be required in a double dose in some lineages. And in particular, for example, ATRX is a gene that escapes in the trophectoderm. And we know that the ATRX protein associates with the inactive X, at least in some cells, in these sorts of tissues. So maybe you do need a double dose of some proteins in some very specific cell types. And this is what we would like to try and understand now. Does it have a role, and what are the mechanisms? And could it be that TADs might be drivers of escape, or could it be that SKPs are driving TADs? And that's where I'll end, and I want to thank the people who did the work in my lab. This is actually a very old photo. I apologize to those of you in my team, but I lost all of my computer last week, I ended up having to scramble around a bit. So I do want to have a special say to El Fej, who was the person who really did the first 5C work in my lab and who helped in our discovery of the TADs. Luca Giorgetti, who was a physicist postdoc who joined the lab, and he actually has been the person who's been behind much of the work that I showed you in collaboration with the Obdekas lab, together with Michael Attia. Anne-Valérie Jeanrel was the person, again with Michael, who generated and analyzed these NPC lines that I mentioned to you. Catherine Corbel's work I alluded to just a little bit, and I do want to say a special thanks to all of the imaging collaborators that we have, in particular John Sadat, who was actually behind the creation of the OMX microscope that we know and love and use so much, and Tristan Piolo, who's been a fantastic help in allowing us to get imaging data to parallel our C data. So thank you very much.